So first of all, thank you for coming this morning. Second, thank you to Dr. Berger and to Dr. Cohen and to Stu Halperin for arranging this event and for inviting me to speak. So does everybody have a source sheet? So today we're going to discuss some of the controversies surrounding the writing of the very first Kabbalistic texts. And what I'll try to show is that at stake in these controversies is really something very, very essential about the nature in which Kabbalah is conceived. Something very essential about the nature of Kabbalah comes across from these controversies. So what I'll do is give some background, and then we're going to turn to the source sheet and look at some of the particular documents that pertain to these controversies. So the very first Kabbalistic texts we have come from southern France and in Catalonia at the beginning of the 13th century, the first half of the 13th, 1-3 century. So what do I mean when I say first Kabbalistic texts? So first of all, I mean texts written by people who call themselves Kabbalists. The people who wrote these texts are the very first people who, as far as we know, refer to themselves as Mekubalim. Secondly, what they write about, they refer to it as Kabbalah. And then finally, the basic ideas contained in these texts are the ideas that come to be characteristic of Kabbalah really for the centuries, especially the notion of the Sefirot, of these 10 emanations that are seen by Mekubalim as constituting the nature of God. Now, there are certainly earlier texts of Jewish mysticism. So for example, there's the so-called Hichalot Corpus, which dates from late antiquity, which describes mystical ascents through seven heavens until finally in the seventh heaven, the mystic has this vision of God sitting on the chariot. And later Kabbalists do in fact look back at this material and say, oh, this is Kabbalistic material. But technically speaking, this material never calls itself Kabbalistic. The word Kabbalah never appears. And the notion of the Sefirot and the way that they're understood by the Mekubalim does not appear in this literature. Then, of course, there's also the Zohar. And as you may know, there's a controversy about when the Zohar was written, whether it was a text from late antiquity, from the second century, written by Shimon Bar Yochai, or whether it was a much later text, the text written at the end of the 13th century. But according to all positions, that is to say, even according to the position that it was an early text written by Shimon Bar Yochai, it wasn't known, it wasn't disseminated until the end of the 13th century. So it wasn't a text that had any impact on Jewish history until, 70 or 80 years after the text we're going to look at were written. And then finally, there's also Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah, another ancient text. And Sefer Yetzirah is, in fact, the first text that uses the term Sefirot. That term Sefirot comes from Sefer Yetzirah. But it's very unclear what Sefer Yetzirah actually meant by this term Sefirot. And as a matter of fact, long before Mekubalim ever commented on Sefer Yetzirah, so Jewish philosophers also commented on it. So for example, we have a commentary on Sefer Yetzirah by Sadia Gaon, who did not understand the Sefirot as aspects of God, but understood them very differently. So for all intents and purposes, the material we're going to look at today, from the beginning of the 13th century, these are the very first Kabbalistic texts. Now, these texts were written by a circle of scholars, as I mentioned, living in southern France and in Catalonia. Major figures include, and these are figures who are not widely known outside of scholarship, but major figures include Ezra ben Shlomo, lived in Gerona, in a city in Catalonia. Azriel also lived in Gerona. Yaakov ben Sheshet, another Mekubal, lived in the same city. In southern France, we have a Mekubal known as Asher ben David, and a number of other Kabbalists who all knew each other, all sort of functioned as part of the same circle. Now, when I say that they wrote the first Kabbalistic text, and they wrote, we have a relatively large collection of texts from this circle, I don't mean that they invented this material from scratch. What I mean is that this is the moment in Jewish history when what was formerly an oral tradition, and that is to say a tradition that was passed down either from master to disciple or from father to son over the generations, was for the very first time at this point in the 13th century put down into writing. So what we get is this moment of transition from the oral to the written, which is a crucial moment for the history of Kabbalah. Now, on the other hand, and this will become very important to what I have to say later on, they didn't merely transmit what was oral into writing, but in the process of writing down the oral traditions, they also expanded them, developed them, added to them. So that's this circle. Now, this circle had a teacher by the name of Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, Isaac the Blind. Now, Isaac the Blind, a southern French scholar from very, very important rabbinic stock. His father was the Ravid. His grandfather was Avraham ben Yitzchak of Narbonne, really leading halachic figures of the day. He, unlike his students, did not write any Kabbalistic texts. And in fact, what we know about his teachings, we know from his students. Now, there is a commentary on Sefer Yetzirah attributed to him, but it seems like, in fact, this was a commentary written by his students on the basis of his own teachings. And it's not only that he didn't write Kabbalistic texts. As we'll see soon, he actually was opposed to the writing of them. He felt very strongly that Kabbalistic material should not be written down and should not be disseminated. So that's Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, Isaac the Blind. And then the final figure that we need to throw into the mix is the Ramban, is Nachmanides, who was a contemporary of this group, a little bit younger, lived in Gerona. That is, he lived in the very same town where many of Isaac the Blind's students lived, until he moved to Israel in 1265. Some traditions, in fact, depict him as a student, at least in terms of his Kabbalistic knowledge, as a student of Rav Isaac the Blind's students. But in fact, it seems like he had his own teachers who were different from this circle, even though he clearly was in contact with them. And as we'll see, he was in correspondence with Isaac the Blind, with Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, the teacher of this circle. Now, when he was younger, it seems like he did write some brief Kabbalistic materials, even though it's unclear that he meant them to be disseminated. So we have a commentary on the first chapter of Sefer Yetzirah by the Ramban, which may or may not be authentic. And we have a couple of other short works which may or may not be authentic. And if they are authentic, it seems like he wrote them early on in his career, when he still had a view that Kabbalah could be disseminated. But later on in his career, in his mature stage, he, like Isaac the Blind, agreed that Kabbalah should not be written down, should not be widely disseminated. And unlike Isaac the Blind, who simply didn't write anything down, he sort of comes up with a kind of intermediate position. And for those of you who have studied his commentary on the Torah and a number of his other works, you know that he very often will allude to Kabbalistic tradition. So say, al derech ha'emet, meaning by way of truth. And then he'll, in very, very cryptic terms, really in terms which, unless you're an initiate, unless you kind of already know the basics of Kabbalah, you won't be able to decipher. And in fact, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience, but typically when people read the Ramban al Torah, when they get to that al derech ha'emet, the usual thing to do is right to skip right over it. Certainly that was my day school experience. So Ramban then has a different position. So we basically have three different positions. We have Isaac the Blind, don't write Kabbalistic texts at all. We have the students who wrote Kabbalistic texts at great length. And then we have the Ramban, who you shouldn't write, but it's okay to allude to Kabbalistic materials in his other writings. So what I'd like to do over the course of the rest of this talk this morning is try to clarify these opinions, talk about what's at stake in these opinions, and see how the different views very much relate to how each of these figures, each of these groups, characterized or thought of the nature of Kabbalah. So we're going to begin with source one on your source sheet. Now, source one is a letter, and this is perhaps the most precious text we have that has any information about these very early stages of Kabbalah. It's a letter by Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, by Isaac the Blind, and it's a letter where he's answering the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah, also a well-known figure, also lived in the same city, Gerona, as the Ramban, and in fact, if we didn't have this text, we would never know that Rabbeinu Yonah was a Kabbalist at all. In other words, Rabbeinu Yonah very strictly adhered to not writing any Kabbalistic secrets. The only possible inkling we have that he had any knowledge at all about Kabbalah was this correspondence. Now, unfortunately, we don't have the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah's letter to Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, We only have his answer. But based on his answer, from the tenor of his answer, you can tell that what Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah were concerned about was the fact that students of Yitzchak Sagin Ahor were writing down Kabbalistic secrets. And they apparently had written to Isaac the Blind and said, look, your students are breaking the barriers of secrecy. You know, what do you think about this? So we're going to read an excerpt from this letter. It was discovered by Gershom Shalom, the great scholar of Kabbalah, in a Vatican manuscript. So this is source one, and I'm sorry I don't have an English, so we will I'll read and I'll translate as we go along. So it begins, Pachadati v'yareti al asher ra'iti chachamim u'nevonim v'chasidim she'irichu bilshonam u'fashtu yidahem lichtov gdolot v'nara'ot b'sifrehem u'v'igrotehem. So he says that he was very afraid because he saw scholars, men of understanding, righteous people, chasidim, who spoke at great length, and they extended their hands to write about these great and awesome matters, both in books and in letters. And here it seems like he's talking about his own students, right? They are righteous, they're good guys, but nevertheless they wrote Kabbalistic secrets. V'hadavar hanichtav en lo aron. But, and this is his major concern, once something gets written down, it doesn't have a chest or a cabinet anymore, right? It's no longer contained. As soon as you put it into writing, it can get out. And he explains, right? Ki pamim rabot yovad o yamutu ba'alav v'yagiu hasfarim lidei p'taim u'maligim v'nimtza shem shamayim mitchalel. Because it might happen that the document will get lost, or its owners will die, and the works will end up in the hands of simpletons or fools, maligim, scoffers, and it will cause a chilul Hashem. And we'll talk about the precise nature of this chilul Hashem in a minute. Then he says, v'chen higia elahem, a little bit of a cryptic phrase, but he seems to mean, and this in fact happened, and in fact happened that some of these Kabbalistic texts actually got out, made their way to the public. V'ani imahem b'chayim, v'yizharti elahem, pamim rabot, v'acherei hiperdim mehem, ba takala al yedehem. He says that when I was with them, with my students, that is, I warned them about this many, many times. But after I left them, some kind of mishap, he doesn't explain what this mishap is, but something negative happened as a result of the fact that they wrote down Kabbalistic secrets. And he continues, V'anochi lo ken hirgelti. This was not how I behaved. Ki avotai hayu atzilei ha'aretz u'rabitzei Torah barabim. He says, my forefathers, and remember, the Ravid, Avram ben Yitzchak of Narbonne, leading rabbinic figures, noblemen of the land, they spread Torah far and wide. Lo yatsa davar mipihem. Not a word left their mouth regarding Kabbalistic secrets. Ubitnehagim imahem kishar bnei adam she'en bik'in b'chokhma. Again, a little bit cryptic here, who the imahem is. And also, there seems to be a bit of a manuscript error here. It should probably be kishar, not kasher. But what he seems to be saying is that the Ravid and Avram ben Yitzchak of Narbonne, his father, his grandfather, they treated everyone alike. Even, let's say, there was a Talmud Chacham in his yeshiva who was not a part of this chain of transmission, well, he would treat that Talmud Chacham like anyone else and not reveal Kabbalistic wisdom to them. But just to say, they were really very, very circumspect about who they revealed knowledge of Kabbalah to. V'ra'iti mehem v'lakachti musar. He says, Isaac the Blind says, I saw what they did and I learned my lesson. I took a lesson from them. And then he continues, V'gam shamati meharatzot asher svivotechem. I heard regarding the nations that are around you, he's probably talking about Castile. U'manshei ir Burgos, city in Castile, the city of Burgos. Shehem medabrim begalui bashukim uvarechovot, kemavu halim u'kemavu balim. That in this city of Burgos, there are people just kind of talking openly in the marketplaces, in the streets, in this kind of hasty, in this confused manner. They're kind of spreading Kabbalistic knowledge in this sort of very, very confused way. U'mitoch divrehem nikar shesar liba min halyona v'kotzitzim benitiyot. He says from what they say, from what he's heard about what they're teaching, it's clear that their heart has strayed from God, and they kotzitzim benitiyot, they cut down the plants. Very famous phrase. It's a phrase that comes from the Gemara the Mishnah in Masechet Chagiga. In the four Arba Shenichlasu the Paradise story, the four who entered into the paradise, and one of them, Acher, Elisha ben Avuya, his sin was he was kutzes benetiot. He cut the plants. And I'm clear what that means in the original context, certainly. And we'll talk about the way in which Mekubalim understood that phrase soon, what that sin of cutting down the plants is all about. Then he continues, but in fact, we had Varim, he's talking here about the Sfirot, Miuchadim kishalhevet kshura begacheret, she'adon yachid ve'en lo sheni. The Sfirot are actually united, they're a unity, just like a coal, just like a flame is attached to a coal. And in fact, God is one and has no second. And these last two lines, kishalhevet kshura begacheret, she'adon yachid ve'en sheni, these are both quotes from Sefer Yetzirah, from the very first parak of Sefer Yetzirah. So if you think about his letter here, if you think about these comments, so he's first of all criticizing two different kinds of people. He's criticizing, one, his students. But these students are righteous. They're okay. They understand Kabbalah properly. Their only problem is they're spreading Kabbalah inappropriately, and by so doing, it could get into the wrong hands. Second group is apparently simpletons, non-Kabbalists, people who are kind of randomly in the marketplace expounding on Kabbalistic secrets. And they, he says, have fundamentally misunderstood Kabbalah. And their misunderstanding is that they have cut the plants. Now, cutting the plants for Kabbalistic literature means not properly understanding the nature of divine unity. And divine unity is really a very, very tricky thing when you come to Kabbalah, because the Mekubalim believe that there are 10 aspects of God. And part of Kabbalah is embracing the paradox that these 10 are nevertheless a perfect unity. And cutting the plants refers to the sin of not realizing that the 10 are really a perfect one, of somehow assuming that somehow the 10 are really separable, that somehow you can break one sphira from another sphira. When in fact, the Sfirot, he says, are miyuchadim kishalhevet kshura begachelet, like a coal, like a flame attached to a coal. And if you think of that simile, right, it's an interesting simile, because you can't really pick that point apart, right, where the coal ends and the flame begins, right, because the flame sort of emerges right out of the coal, which is to say there's this very unique bond. So even though rhetorically you can talk about 10 Sfirot, in point of fact, the 10 is really one. And that seems to be the Chilul Hashem that he's worried about. He's worried that, so what's wrong with his students who do understand divine unity? What's wrong with them disseminating this material? Well, other people are going to read this material, and they're going to misunderstand. They're not going to realize the proper nature of divine unity. They're going to think the Mekubalim are polytheists. And then he refers to some kind of takala, some kind of mishap that occurred as a result. And we don't know what this is. It may refer to the events that we're going to read about in the very next source, although usually those events are thought to be somewhat later, but it's unclear. But it may be something as mundane as Mekubalim were being accused of polytheism. And Rabbi Isaac the Blind is clear that this is not his technique. Yeah, sure.
Are they being accused of polytheism, or of kind of like supporting Christianity?
Good. So hold that point. Probably closer to the Christianity critique, which is what we're going to see in the very next text. Yeah, but that's a point well taken. Although it's unclear from the perspective of those who are criticizing if Christianity was any different from polytheism. So he says he's going to act like his own fathers. He's not going to disseminate any Kabbalistic literature. So that for him, to stress the point, the main reason for keeping the material oral, for keeping it out of writing, is that the material may get into the wrong hands and hence may be misunderstood. So now, if you turn down to the next source, this is a letter from Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne. Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne was a leading rabbinic scholar in the 13th century, a contemporary of Leif Mekubalim, lived in Narbonne in southern France. And in a work called Milchemet Mitzvah, which is an anti-Christian polemic, he includes a letter which he had written many years earlier, probably sometime around 1235, 1240, although he doesn't say exactly. So he includes this letter which was circulated to the various communities in southern France, condemning Kabbalah. And it's a very, very, very sharp condemnation of Kabbalah by, as I say, a leading rabbinic figure. So we can read a little bit from his letter. Let's see. So this is now source number 2. V'chtov hena divrei ha'igeret asher katavti zekama. He's going to record in his later book, Milchemet Mitzvah, in his anti-Christian work, this letter that he had written a while earlier. Listor divrei ha'dovrim sara al Hashem v'al ha'chamim ha'olchim b'derchet ha'torah ha'tmima v'yirei Hashem. He's going to try to contradict, try to go against those who speak badly about God, meaning the Kabbalists. They speak badly about God, and they also speak badly in his, from his point of view about Chachamim, about Chazal, who after all follow the ways of the pure Torah and their Yirei Hashem. V'otam haschalim amru levilti tet le'el hakadmon harishon mein reshit v'echarit todaut filah uvracha. These fools, these mekubalim, argued that you shouldn't give blessings, thanksgiving, you shouldn't daven to the eternal God, to the El HaKadmon, to the eternal God, Rishon Men Reshit, who has no beginning, who has no end. And of course, the subtle critique here is, God has no beginning and no end. You, the Mekubalim, say that God has these 10 Sefirot, right? 10 is a limited number. God would seem to have a beginning and an end from your point of view. Ode nafsham mahigia elehem umara ulkacha. You know, woe is to them. What brought them to say such a thing? Natsu kadosh Yisrael nazoru achor b'malam. You know, paraphrasing from Yeshaya, from the very first part of Yeshaya, they turned away from God in their rebellion, and they natsu kadosh Yisrael. They insulted. They defamed the Holy One of Israel. They turn themselves away from God. They turn themselves away from God. You know, epithet for God. God who is the eternal dwelling place, who's one and only, who has no beginning and no end, no other God beside him. And here's the key line. God is a perfect unity. He's not a unity that involves the shituf, the combination, association, and siruf, the conjoining of sfirot. So this notion that there are 10 sfirot that are somehow one, doesn't buy it. He sees this as heretical. This is the same as saying that there are many gods. He continues, Vayu diraon l'chol basar, Tolat sichlutam lo tamut ve'esh pichonam lo tichbe. They're a disgrace to all flesh. This is quoting from the very, or at least paraphrasing from the very end of Yeshaya. The worm of their folly will never die. The flame of their stupidity will never be extinguished. Ki oy le'elokut harbe. You know, woe is to them that they say there are many gods. Vamru b'chisaron da'atam, they said in their defective, from their defective point of view, ki kulam devukim zeim ze v'kol echad. They're all cleaved to one another, all the sefirot cleave to one another, and they're all one. And then this is the key line which relates to the question that was asked earlier. Ayim yesh bizmanenu b'chol hevlei emunot ha'umot b'yichud Hashem yitbarach yoter me'ele. Is there anyone from all the nations of the world, and here he's presumably referring to Christianity, right, who has a more extreme, a worse idea about the nature of divine unity than these mekubalim do? Then he says, "Darshu v'chikru hetev v'im hem bekibrichem ba'aru otam min ha'aretz." Search out for them. Look for these books. He's talking about Kabbalistic books here. If you find them, burn them. V'lo yelachem lepuka. They won't be a source of failure. They won't be a michshol for you. V'chatatu acharehem. Search after them. We burned the books that we found among us. In other words, in Narbonne, sometime in the beginning of the 13th century, there actually was a burning of Kabbalistic books. And this is sort of the burning that you never hear about, right? There's the famous burning of the Rambam's books, of course, a little bit later on, or actually not a little bit later on, even possibly, depending on when to date this, at roughly the same time. There's the burning of the Talmud in Paris a little bit later on. But also there were Kabbalistic books burned in the early part of the 13th century. in southern France. And he's recommending, and who knows who listened to him on this recommendation, you know, wherever you find these Kabbalistic books, burn them. Right, God will send us a redeemer. He will ingather the exiles. He'll remove from the hearts of his nation any of their doubts, their confusions. Right, there's going to be ultimately, you know, he's praying for a kind of general reconciliation, and everything should work out well. So if you think about the specifics of what Rav Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne says, first of all, he says that Kabbalah is all made up, right? It's invented. Second of all, he says that Kabbalim deny divine unity. And third, he says it's worse than Christianity. At least that's what he implies. And presumably that's why he included this work, this letter, in his anti-Christian polemic, right? To underscore that point. That Kabbalists believe in 10, it's even worse in some way than Christians who believe in 3. And ultimately, so how did Rav Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne know about Kabbalah? Well, later on in the letter, he says that he heard from various people, but he also read Kabbalistic books. He read, in fact, he names the books, and the books he names are these very same books written by Isaac the Blind's students. Which is to say, Isaac the Blind's worry was really very well founded. Just as he was worried, people would get hold of these texts, people who were not Mekubalim, and would come to the conclusion, erroneous from Isaac the Blind's point of view, that Mekubalim are polytheists, or at the very least, just as bad, if not worse, than Christianity, because they don't properly understand divine unity. And if you think about it, the previous esotericism had actually really worked, because when Rav Meir ben Shimon sees this material, he regards it as new, as made up. In other words, he who had no Kabbalistic tradition, he who was not the recipient of this oral tradition from generation to generation, had never seen this before. And to him, it really did look like this was brand new stuff, and not just brand new stuff, brand new heretical stuff. Now, we saw that Rav Isaac, in his letter, was responding to the Ramban, and the Ramban presumably was also concerned about the dissemination of Kabbalistic secrets. But we also mentioned he kind of had this middle-of-the-road position where he alluded to Kabbalistic ideas without explaining them. So what exactly is his point of view? Right? What is his point of view about writing Kabbalistic secrets, about the nature of esotericism? So here we're going to look at a passage, a very well-known passage. This is the only well-known passage of the ones we're going to look at, from his Haktama al Sefer Breshit, from his introduction to Sefer Breshit, in his commentary on the Torah. This is really from the very, very end of his commentary. So this is now source number 3 on your sheets. He says, "V'ani hineni mevi bevrit nemana, yanotenet etza hogenet, v'chol mistakel b'sefer hazeh, v'val yisbor svara, ועליחשוב מחשבות בדבר מכל הרמזים אשר אני כותב בסתרי התורה, כי אני מודיעו נאמנה שלא יושגו ולא ידעו כלל בשום שכל ובינה זולתי מפי מקובל חכם ואוזן מקובל מבין." He says he's going to bring into a faithful covenant which will give proper advice to anyone who looks at his book, anyone who looks at his commentary on the Torah, not to use any kind of logical reasoning, any kind of svara, think any kind of thoughts at all, to try to understand any of the hints, any of the allusions that the Ramban includes in his commentary on the Torah. And he says, "I want to let you know with certainty, ani modio ne'amana, that none of them can be understood at all with any kind of sechel or bina, with any kind of human intellect, any kind of human wisdom. The only way they can be understood is mipi mekubal chacham ozen mekubal mevin," right? From the mouth of a wise mekubal into the ear of an understanding mekubal. Only oral transmission is the appropriate way to discuss this material. Vesvara bahen ivelet, machshava moelet, rabat hanizakin, monat hatoelet, any kind of svara, any kind of logical reasoning applied to these Kabbalistic secrets is foolish. It's an inappropriate thought. And it'll cause great damage and it'll have no benefit whatsoever. Al yamen b'shav nit'a ki lo tevo'eyuth b'svaratav rak ra'a. Don't trust any kind of vanity that will leave you that will lead you astray, because all this will bring you to is all this all svarot, all logical reasoning will bring you to is bad, is ra'ah. Ki debru el Hashem sara asher lo yachlu kapara. Right, trying to expound upon these Kabbalistic secrets is speaking badly, is speaking ill of God, for which there is no atonement. So it makes a really very very strong statement about not applying human reason in any way or form to Kabbalistic literature. And it seems that a number of scholars have made this point, that for the Ramban, Kabbalah was a closed tradition. Which is to say, Kabbalah is simply material that gets passed down from master to disciple, and it can't be expounded upon at all. It's the secrets that we know, that's what we have. There's no expanding, developing, extrapolating. Kabbalah is just this closed set of material, and all the Mikubal can do is just pass on to his choice students just the tradition as he received it. And I think his point is here, and this could be shown elsewhere as well, that even in a situation where there is a teacher alone in a room with his disciple, even then, he couldn't explain, develop, expound, right? The only job of that teacher is to say, look, this is the tradition as I received it, here's what it means. Nothing else. So it's interesting. If you go back and compare the Ramban and Rav Yitzchak Sagin Ahura, so we saw that the Yitzchak Sagin Ahura was worried about disseminating Kabbalistic secrets lest they be misunderstood. Now, it's quite possible that the Ramban was worried about this too. He also didn't want misunderstanding. But at least from here, it seems like his main worry is not misunderstanding, even though the two are not mutually exclusive, but his main worry is that human beings will try to apply their own reason, try to develop, try to expand Kabbalistic material. Now, if you look at what we know from the writings of Yitzchak Sagin, not from his writings, because he didn't write, but from the teachings of his students, what his students tell us about his own views, and from this commentary on Sefer Yetzirah that his students wrote on the basis of his own teachings, it's very clear that Isaac the Blind does not view Kabbalah in the same manner as the Ramban does. He thinks that it's absolutely okay to expand Kabbalah, to develop it, and the teachings that we have from him are full of his own reasoning, his own speculations, his own attempts to bring together his own received traditions with what he's learned from philosophic material, from the Rambam, from Ibn Ezra, from others. So what we get is both of them agreeing on the point that Kabbalah should not be disseminated, but for somewhat different reasons. Isaac the Blind would have no problem if in that secret room talking to his students, there's an open discussion. You can talk, develop, expand. It just shouldn't go out of that room. Isaac the Blind, the Ramban, on the other hand, even in that private room, would argue only transmit what you received, no expanding, no developing. And if you go back to the passage we just read from the Ramban a moment ago, so scholars have actually argued that this text is a polemic, and two possible targets have been identified. One target is Maimonides, the Ramban, with a mem, because one of the things the Rambam did was claim that Maaseh Merkava, Maaseh Breshit, right, the esoteric traditions of Judaism that the Mishnah talks about, the Mishnah which says you can't expound them in public, you can't expound them in the open, he argued that that material has been lost, but we can recover it through human reason, in particular by turning to Aristotle and by extrapolating from Aristotle what these ancient Jewish esoteric traditions are. And it's clear that that would very much raise the ire of the Ramban, who says, what are you talking about? There's a very set set of traditions. We know exactly what they are. You can't use human reason to develop them, to expand upon them. But the other possible target is actually Rav Isaac the Blind's students themselves. Because they, on the one hand, yes, they agreed that Maaseh Bereshit and Maaseh Merkava, that the Mishnah talks about, was not Aristotle. They thought that there were traditions which had been transmitted to them, which did capture what really was Maaseh Bereshit and Maaseh Merkava. But on the other hand, they also thought that you could move beyond that and you could expand upon it, you could develop it. And from that point of view, the Ramban's critique could equally apply to them as well. And in fact, the two possibilities are not mutually exclusive. I mean, it's not at all hard to imagine the Ramban sort of giving a blanket condemnation to anyone, Maimonideans or the other Kabbalists, who would think that in any way Jewish esotericism can be recovered or developed or expanded through human reason. So what I'd like to do now is turn to our final source. This is a text by Yaakov ben Sheshet. He is one of the Mikubalim who lived in Gerona. Perhaps not a direct student of Yitzhak Sagi Nehor, may have never learned with him directly, but probably learned with his students, and cites Isaac the Blind many, many times. And this is from a text called Shar HaShamayim, which is intended as a popular text. He's writing it to teach to the masses the nature of Kabbalah, and it's mostly sort of an account of the different sefirot. So here he's talking about the sefirot. He says, "V'hineni mevaer inyanim kafi yecholti." I'm going to explain the sefirot insofar as I can do so. "U'masher kibalti, masher yagati, ufilpalti, hosafti v'igdalti." Both from what I received, but also based on my own toil, my own intellectual exertion, my own pilpul, right? My own, I don't know how to translate pilpul. Pilpul. Sophistry. But sophistry has a bit of a negative valence. Creative reasoning, let's say. Hosafti v'igdalti. I added, I expanded. Moach hachadim reikodesh mivinehem. I'm not going to withhold any of these words of holy words, these words of Kabbalah, from those who can understand them. Leman yidu dor acharon banim yilodu yakumu v'yisapru lifnehem. So that it will be known in a later generation, children will be born and they'll tell their own children. Right? This will become widely known. I'm going to explain some of these, sweet words of truth, Kabbalistic words. I'm going to build up its runes. My words will enlighten anyone to whom they are left. I'm going to open up doors. Locks are going to break down. The Sharim lo yisagru, gates will no longer be closed. Kabbalistic wisdom will be open, will be known, will be available. When I provide for each, and here the inyanim means sefirot, for each sefira, I'm going to provide, matters and sort of basic underpinnings, issues similar to it, and that depend on it, so that, whatever I don't explain, the rushim l'chol chatsehem, Haven ulmad vina nimsa l'sheino nimsa. Right? Anything that I don't explain, well, you'll be able to figure it out on your own, right? Extrapolate from what I tell you, from what you know, to what you don't know. And in the end, yafutsu mayinotecha chutza. You should, a pasuk from Mishlei, your wellspring should burst forth. This is a pasuk which has a very important afterlife in Chabad Chasidut. For those who know, this pasuk was sort of taken as a rallying call by Chabad and earlier Chasidut as well. Even by the Baal Shem Tov already, to spread the wisdom of Kabbalah, or the Hasidic version of Kabbalah, far and wide. So if you think about what he's saying here, though, his comments are really, exactly the opposite of the Ramban. His point is that he's going to explain material for future generations. The only way you can ensure that future generations will have access to it is to put it into writing. And he describes Kabbalah not as something closed, but as something open, right? Something you can expound, develop, expand, extrapolate. Kabbalah is open wisdom which must be diffused. So on the one hand, he agrees with his teacher, Rav Yitzchak, that Kabbalah is open wisdom, and he stands in opposition to the Ramban. But on the other hand, he disagrees with both the Ramban and Rav Yitzchak on the matter of writing Kabbalistic secrets. Okay, so why then did Rav Isaac's students break from their master's approach and write down Kabbalistic wisdom? In other words, why did they not heed his warnings? So here the answer seems to lie, again, in Maimonides, in the Rambam. Because as I mentioned, the Rambam claimed that he could figure out, he could rediscover the lost ancient esoteric traditions of Judaism through reading Aristotle. And arguably, and there's, you know, various texts which we could bring to support this, these first Mikubalim felt that they had to set the record straight. They had to show that, wait a minute, what the Rambam says is what Maimonides says is true Jewish esotericism, that's incorrect, because we have the traditions ourselves. But the irony of it is that even while on the one hand they wanted to kind of set the record straight, show that they had the truth, they nevertheless took a kind of page out of the Rambam's book and were very willing to expand and develop their traditions. How about the Ramban? Well, arguably the Ramban also had an interest in combating Maimonides. The Ramban with a Nun had an interest in combating Maimonides with a Mem. And perhaps the point of these allusions is, well, to make it clear, you know they're there, so you know there is an alternative to Maimonides' teachings. You know there is a true wisdom, but you can't know what it is, right? So you kind of have it both ways. You both prevent that. You both present the alternative, but you present speculation. And then finally, Rav Yitzchak Seginohar himself, why was he not concerned about the Rambam? Well, we don't know. All we can assume is that for him, esotericism was apparently a greater value than the value of trying to set the record straight and combat the Rambam's own teachings. And let me just say, by way of conclusion, that if you then think about the rest of the history of Kabbalah, and with various ups and downs along the way, but really the position that finally won out was the position of Isaac the Blind's students. So that certainly you can go into your local Jewish bookstore and buy, you know, a plethora of Kabbalistic books. Look, you can go on an online database and download a plethora of Kabbalistic books. Kabbalistic books were printed widely. And I think it's fair to say that if you would take Rav Isaac the Blind's students, or Rav Isaac the Blind himself, or the Ramban, or any of these figures, and you put them, you know, fast forward a few hundred years to the future, and put them in the Beit Midrash of the Ari, in the 16th century, and you know, they were sitting listening, I think it's fair to say that a lot of what the Ari was teaching would be absolutely foreign to them. Why? Because Kabbalah did not remain static. It did develop, and it did expand as the generations progressed. So I think I can take some questions. We have, well, I guess we have a few minutes. Yeah.
You mentioned that there was apparently a burning of Sifrei Kabbalah
in Narbonne, yeah.
Do we have any reaction from the Talmidei Rav Yitzchak Seginohar to that burning? Or was there any conversation between, you know,
we have,
the Kabbalim and the non-Kabbalim about this?
We have one cryptic passage from Isaac the Blind's nephew, which a guy named Asher ben David, which may allude to it. But in my opinion, and this is something that I can't prove, I think that a lot of the material from this period was lost. And I think a lot of it was probably purposely lost, because ultimately, sort of, Kabbalah eventually, kind of historically, won out over Jewish philosophy. And to the extent that those who were critiquing Kabbalah were aligned with philosophic points of view, I think various critiques which must have been existed and various material that must have developed this more, you know, was kind of expunged. I mean, of course, that's a speculation, but the fact of the matter is, you would think this is a major event, and we really don't have details about it.
I understand the Ramban's approach very well about even whether it's, say, finished or not, but the point is, he says, I don't want to write it down, since this is sort of like the things that Marin Klai Yod say should be passed,
right.
The Yichidut from only through Ramazim, from a Rebbe to a Talmud.
Right.
And that I can understand much more than the position of the Talmidim
of Yitzchak. Right, I mean, it's interesting that you would think that the Talmidim of Seginohar would be worried about this halachically, that there'd be a lot of sort of, you know, a lot of halachic justifications. How can we violate the Mishnah and Chagiga that puts very strict strictures on, you know, the Mishnah in Dershin, that puts very strict strictures on the transmission of Kabbalistic knowledge. And the fact of the matter is, you don't. I mean, in other words, those strictures are simply, ignored, at least in the material we have, by Isaac LeBlanc's students, which is an interesting phenomenon. And apparently they felt that this challenge from the Rambam was so great that, you know, it was kind of et asot la'ashem kind of moment, you know, a time to even perhaps go against the strict halacha for the good of preserving... they saw it as preserving Judaism, because they felt like one of the influences of the Rambam claiming that he knew Jewish esotericism, and it was Aristotle, and it was, etc., was that people were not keeping halacha anymore, that there were radical followers of the Rambam who were not davening, who weren't engaging in a variety of mitzvot. And they sort of felt like you needed Kabbalah, Rambam's followers, not the Rambam himself, but the Rambam's... Both in literature from the Mikubalim itself and literature from the Maimonidean controversy in the 1230s, one of the major attacks against, not the Rambam, the Rambam is usually insulated from this, but against his students, or against his followers, that is to say, was that they were not properly keeping halacha. And that they sort of thought that the only thing that really counts is the study of philosophy, is the study of Aristotle, and there therefore no reason to put on tefillin. I mean, you're right, but there was a very radical contingent of Maimonideans in southern France. So yes, I mean, apparently, despite the Mishnah Torah, of course, you could argue it's all propaganda. You know, we don't have, you know, it's all the anti-Maimonideans, you know, and their propaganda. But you know, but that is what they say.
Did all Kabbalistic writings that we have sort of stemmed from the school then,
Yeah, I mean, the Ramban seems to have had somewhat of a different teacher. The Ramban had a teacher named Yehuda ben Yakar, and then there's a mysterious teacher identified by his students called Ben Blima. And Ben Blima, we don't know who that is. We don't know what that means. So the Ramban seems to have had somewhat of a different teacher, although it very much overlaps. But yeah, largely speaking, it all sort of branches out from this group, and it develops in various ways.
Is there anything about Christian staying in secure?
Why this blossomed in Christian Spain in particular? So the argument is, or at least the plausible argument is, that it has to do with the Rambam and with Jewish philosophy in general. Because Jewish philosophy had been written in Arabic, right? Jews in Christian lands had no access to Arabic. But at this period, this is when the Arabic material begins to be translated into Hebrew. So suddenly, and it caught like wildfire in both southern France and Catalonia. All this philosophical stuff, the Guide of the Perplexed, but also Sadia Gaon and Chovot HaLevavot, and a whole range of such materials, and was now available and suddenly being widely accepted. So the argument is that maybe that is what was the kind of impetus. That's what made Kabbalists say, okay, we've got to, and that goes back to Isaac LeBlanc's students, we better write this down, because otherwise this philosophy is going to entirely take over. So that's the particular historical circumstance. No, that's much later. That's Renaissance. Pico is Renaissance. No, he was not until the I believe the 16th century. Pico. That's a phenomenon known as Christian Kabbalah. There were a number of Renaissance philosophers, including Pico and Reuchlin and a number of others, who interpreted the Kabbalah in Christological terms, and sort of thought they could read into the Zohar and into other Kabbalistic works Christian ideas. And then they left a lot of writings trying to expound Kabbalah LP Christianity. So the very first time the Zohar was known about was the very end of the 13th century. So, you know, almost the turn of the 14th century. In the 1390s is the first time we have reports about the Zohar. This material was written, you know, in the 1230s. Sorry, I meant 1290s, not 1390s. The Zohar was first reported in the 1290s, 1300 or so. This material was written in the 1230s or so. So about, 60 or so years, 70 or so years earlier. And there's a number of other texts that come after this, before the Zohar is known. There's a pretty voluminous literature from the 13th century. Are there questions, comments? Yeah.
Why particularly in Narbonne was the fire happened?
It's a good question.
Was it a result of the Albigensian Crusade?
I don't. People have theorized that the Albigensian Crusade was an issue. This is in southern France at the time. There was a heretical sect, heretical by Christian terms, called the Cathars. They were a kind of Gnostic sect, who were heavily persecuted by the Church, and some have theorized that people like Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne and others were very, very worried that Kabbalah would look to the Christian authorities like the Cathar heresy, and it would be grouped together. And somehow, in these attacks and the crusade against these Christian heretics, the Jews would be kind of swept up as well. So it certainly is not impossible that's a factor. Yeah. Are there questions or comments? Okay. In that case, thank you very much.